This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
Scarcity is a great filter against arbitrariness. You are not allowed to do whatever you want. You need to justify what you're doing.
We'll hear from the Pritzker Prize winner Alejandro Aravena, talking about politics, climate change, and the role of architecture in turbulent times. Plus...
They've curated this show because they have looked harder than anyone has ever looked at our collection before.
We head to Vienna for a newly opened exhibition curated by the film director Wes Anderson and his partner, the illustrator Yaman Malouf. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. Known for solving social housing issues on a shoestring budget, and of course for nabbing the Pritzker Prize back in 2016, Chilean architect Alejandro Aravena doesn't see architecture as just building things. No, no, he sees it as an agent of social change. For an overview of his oeuvre, which ranges from disaster relief projects to social housing and universities, there's a seemly new book out. Named for the maverick Santiago-based architect studio, Elemental is published by Fiden and released in early December. Monocle's very own Jonathan Whitfield sat down with Aravena and started by asking how this book came about.
This book is about the buildings that we have done in the office. It started with our very beginnings, in my case, back in 85 as a student, and it covers how we came a practice and all the buildings that have brought us here. What we try to balance in the office is at least three-thirds. Social housing with a very tough budget conditions, and when I say tough, I'm talking about $10,000 per family with which you have to buy the land, provide the infrastructure and build the house. Then another third is buildings, and this is what mainly is in this book, where we train our designers' muscles to be able to engage social housing, for example, or the other end of the spectrum, city design. And this other one maybe started in 2010 when an 8.8 Richter scale earthquake hit Chile with a tsunami afterwards, and there was a massive destruction, and we were required to rebuild an entire city. So this three-thirds, city, buildings, and housing, is what we normally try to have in our drawing boards. In the end, what we architects do is to give form to the places where people live. It's not more complicated than that, but also not easier than that. As soon as you double-click on this word, giving form, well, what informs the form of those projects? What are the forces at play? And it's a rather wide range of things beyond aesthetics. That is what society expects from us. As I said, economics, politics, the environment, and all these forces have to be integrated and hopefully synthesized in a design. In addition to that is, which are those places where people live? Well, they range from housing to houses to buildings to parks to infrastructure to the sidewalk to the curb of the sidewalk. All those places inevitably have to have a form. And with that form, we can improve people's life or we can ruin them, unfortunately, for a rather long period of time. So you better make sure that you have identified carefully the forces at play so that when delivering it in the form of a proposal, will be able to improve people's life and common good. And finally, it's life itself. That is, it ranges from basic needs to the most intangible desires and the mysterious aspects of the human condition. And again, it's one, not one or the other. It's all of them.
Something that is particularly pertinent that comes across in all of the work that you do is a very strong social conscience, even if it is, you know, social housing, urban design, it's on a huge scale. So it's not simply affordable housing. It's so much more than that. So have, for example, the factitious and divisive politics of the US, of the Americas, affected the way you work, affected the way that your studio design buildings?
So let me start by clarifying something. It's true that we're better known or most known for social housing, but not even for a second we have ever claimed any kind of moral superiority, why architects should be going into this field, not for a second. The reason why we are there, it's because it's a difficult question. It's a question with intellectual merit. And if anything, social housing requires professional quality, not professional charity. For some reason, society is not willing to pay for the time for qualified professionals, from designers to engineers to builders to social workers to policymakers, to create the conditions for how we're going to create and deliver the built environment for billions of people in the world. So we decided to enter this field because we think it's a difficult question. The way we engage this conversation is through design. We're talking about this condition of architecture nowadays. I guess that we are trying to put at the service of a non-specific question. Questions like poverty, inequalities, underdevelopment, insecurity. These are all questions that we are interested in as a citizen. In that sense, are non-specific. But we are trying to address them through the specific knowledge of architecture, which is to translate the forces that are around here in a, first of all, in a proposal key, and second, in a built form. In the end, we have to live somewhere. And through that, we can improve common good and people's quality of life or ruin them, as I was saying before. One of the things that we decided very early on was to accept the rules of the game, the constraints that are out there in the world for several reasons. One of the most important ones is that eventually, in this very charged, challenging environment, you have a point, you find a new clue and can introduce a new light in fields where we were somehow kind of used to give up quality. One would like that contribution to be replicated as many times as possible. If you ask for too many exceptions, then the market, governments, the society in general has the perfect excuse for not doing it again. So we were very careful in swallowing all the constraints, all the policy, that in principle sometimes is not enough. It's true it's not enough, and that's why it requires to think it twice or three times or four times so that we can deliver a better built environment. So among those rules of the game, there are situations that you have described: insufficient funding, a politician that may have the wrong approach to common good, or not being able to understand that inequalities are not just a human tragedy, but is what makes our societies unstable. So what we've been trying to do is that within that set of constraints, is not that we are supporting them, but something has to be done. In the meantime, we try to work, and the book in that sense, it's important. If those rules of the game are not fair, instead of waiting until them to change, we are doing something. That's why we call our practice a do tank, not a think tank. But as a think tank, if those rules of the game need to be rethought, reframed, relaunched, or questioned, including those that made those rules, then we're willing to do that. But our way to comment reality is through projects. If we have a problem with inequalities, we look at the city as a shortcut towards equality, since it can improve people's quality of life without having to depend entirely or wait for income redistribution, which is almost the only thing one listens nowadays as a solution to inequalities, that I guess it's one of the major agreements that and challenges that we have nowadays as a society.
Architect Alejandro Aravena there, and we'll hear more from him later in the show. We're such teasers, aren't we? But first, we're off to Vienna. Vienna's Kunsthistorisches Museum is going all out for a new exhibition. The show on the works of Peter Bruegel the Elder added a twist to its usual pageantry, and that's all thanks to the talented eye of filmmaker Wes Anderson and designer and artist Yulman Maluf. The pair combed through the museum's enviable inventory to pick out the pieces that took their fancy. The resulting exhibition opened to great fanfare last week, and it's everything you'd expect from such a high-octane curatorial team. Monocle's very own Alexei Korolev in Vienna reports.
Think of any Wes Anderson film. Think of what makes it a Wes Anderson film.
the colours, the textures, the intricate arrangement of objects on the screen. Now take a still frame from it and put that still frame on the wall.
We've never done anything like this before. We've never hung paintings at the level of people's knees. We've never hung objects 6 inches off the ground. We've never used wall colours like this before. We've never hung our galleries with felt before.
This should give you some idea of what Wes Anderson and his wife, Jemaine Maalouf, have done here at the Kunsthistorisches Museum. But as the show's co-curator Jasper Sharp explains, there's more to it than that.
They're putting forward an alternative. I wouldn't say they are undermining the established systems of values on which the museum is based. I wouldn't say they are being deliberately provocative, willfully provocative. I would say that they are putting a question mark around certain things. Is this the right way to be doing things? Is there an alternative way for these objects to be seen? How were these objects originally shown in the private universes that the Habsburgs had in their castles and palaces and so on? I think they're also referring back to the origins of collecting generally. The very first collectors on Earth collected functionally. Wood to make a fire, sharp stones to kill animals. It was only later that aesthetic collecting came in, probably pretty stones in different colors and shapes and sizes. So I think they're also referring back to this sort of more intuitive and functional form of collecting that existed long before the Enlightenment and all our museums were laid out in a very sort of academic manner.
My wife and I jumped at Jasper Sharp's offer to curate our own version of the greatest hits of the Kunsthistorische because we thought it was going to be easy. We thought in particular it would be easy because our tastes and interests in colors and shapes and light and shadow in art were so similar as to be almost interchangeable, and that we would briskly choose several pieces that we both love, and that would be that. And of course we were wrong.
The exhibition came out of a chance meeting between Jasper Sharp and Wes Anderson and Jemaine Maalouf in January 2015. But the format had been there for some time already.
So we began a series of exhibitions in 2012 for which we invite remarkable creative individuals to spend a sustained period of time looking at our collections, meeting our curators, meeting our conservators, diving deep into our storage rooms, into our laboratories, and making a selection of works for a public exhibition. We're not the first museum to have done this. I looked very much at certain historical precedents. In America, great exhibition by Andy Warhol, which celebrates its 50th anniversary next year, Raid the Icebox. A great series that the National Gallery in London did for many years called The Artist's Eye. So we're really continuing a tradition which is already established within the museum world, but which we had never done ourselves.
Hello, this is Wes Anderson. I'm here at the Kunsthistorische Museum in Vienna. We're going to make our own little personal contribution to the audio guide here, and we have Jason Schwartzman. Come on in the door, Jason.
Hello, hello.
Hello. Jason has just set foot in our little exhibition for the first time.
Wow.
And he is going to now host us through it as he discovers these little spaces.
What is the oldest piece in this room? And
the oldest piece in the entire exhibition is in this room. And it is this
feeling about that.
Tiny little necklace.
That's right.
For the co-curator Jasper Sharp, one of the most interesting things about the project is the work that was done behind the scenes and the relationships that were built as a result.
There was a sort of mutual wariness to begin with. They were wary of the curators because they're highly intelligent, studied individuals, and Wes and Jemaine are very keen art historians, but they're not people who've been through university to study art history. And there was wariness from the other side as well, because our curators were thinking, you know, who are these people who are arranging objects by color and by size, rather than provenance or exhibition history or rarity. But as soon as they began to understand the sort of the soul of the exhibition, the look of the exhibition, every single one of them to the last person embraced it from all 14 collections. And they became increasingly proud of getting their objects from their own collections into the exhibition. So it sort of flipped at a certain point from a certain sort of healthy mutual suspicion into a real team effort. And I would say about half the objects in the exhibition, more than 200, came as suggestions from our curators, things that they had never shown before themselves, but whose existence they were aware of in the collection.
Another curious thing about the exhibition is that there are no labels anywhere in sight. To find out what this or that object is, you need to consult a special booklet.
It's very faithful to how they look at objects, and they don't look at labels in museums. In fact, if they see something that remotely smells like a masterpiece, they walk in the other direction normally. They had a favorite painting in the exhibition for many years without even realizing it was a Titian. They genuinely want people to look at the objects. They've curated this show because they have looked harder than anyone has ever looked at our collection before. Second reason is there are simply too many objects. And thirdly, it does go back to this idea of the sort of the private space, the studiolo, the Wunderkammer, the cabinet of curiosity. No one who collects in a private sense puts a label next to something. That is an essentially public offering you're doing when you put a label next to it. Now, museums have labels, and we are in a museum. But they've tried to create a different type of space.
Going back to the claim of Wes's and Germaine's, do you think this exhibition, you know, in very general terms, is going to change the way people approach this museum and an exhibition like that?
Do you know, I'll answer that by telling you that I got an email from one of our curators who worked very closely with them on the exhibition. And he sent me an email the morning after the opening to say, I just want to say I'm so grateful for the opportunity I have had to work with these people. They have given me completely fresh eyes through which to view my collection. And if this is our own curators who already know these objects, if they're reacting like this, then I can only hope that the public will follow that. Will it change how we present our collection? I think the madness of it, the idea of this explosion of objects that we have in this one room now, might possibly lead us in the path of creating a gallery which more closely resembles this type of insatiable mania for accumulation which Wes and Germaine have tapped into, which characterized the Habsburgs in the first place. So I think it's a kind of watch this space in terms of what it does. Does it have the potential to do that? I think so, absolutely, yeah.
Spitzmaus, Mummy in a Coffin and Other Treasures, that's the name of the exhibition, runs until April next year. For Monocle in Vienna, I'm Alexei Korolev.
And isn't it always a delight to hear from Alexei Korolev in Vienna there? Next, we return to our sit-down with the Chilean architect Alejandro Aravena, who was in London recently to promote his new book about the Santiago-based studio of his, Elemental.
Do you feel positive about architecture's capability to deal with a time of increasingly extreme weather conditions, increasingly extreme problems that arise from planet Earth?
Well, I guess that the effects of global warming and climate change are more and more, well, more recurrent, more violent. But again, in my training in Chile, we've had nature raging even before climate change in the form of earthquakes and tsunamis and volcanic eruptions. So I guess that we've been taught by nature to respect those forces, but yet not to give up. Those forces are so big, there's no point in trying to resist them. But eventually you can either channel that, you can dissipate them, and human ingenuity is about finding a way for how to deal with the forces. In the Chilean environment, for example, gravity, it's irrelevant. I mean, we're building a 17,000-ton building, and gravity is irrelevant. The lateral horizontal acceleration of Earth is more significant. How do you deal with that? Not to talk about a tsunami. I mean, the forces of... It's not a big wave. I mean, it's a mass of water moving at 800 kilometers an hour. So it's pushing laterally. You never, ever will be able to resist. Unfortunately, we had the earthquake in 2010. Tsunami was a kind of new thing for us. 2011 in Japan, you saw this massive infrastructure where waves, as if they were nothing, were going on top of it and still destroying it. So resisting the force of nature, it's useless, and it's using public resources in the wrong way. Yet, if you frame the problem correctly, you may find a way around for protecting the city of Constitución after the earthquake and tsunami to a geographical threat. We came up with a geographical answer, a forest in between the sea and the city to dissipate the energy instead of resisting it by introducing some chaotic movement into the mass of water. So by a bumpy ground on top of trees with a certain diameter, with a certain roots, so that that chaotic movement could be introduced, energy couldn't be reduced by 50%. And after that, you can more or less resist that with the, how do we know, in a conventional condition. Earthquakes, the technology for seismic isolation that we have developed at a very low cost so that we can export that knowledge to third world countries or developing countries in general. Just to give a quick example, the Innovation Center in Santiago is this concrete volume. One of the reasons is that office buildings in a weather like the one of Santiago, that because of the climate change is becoming more and more desertic. It creates a huge greenhouse effect. If you have sun hitting directly a glass, the greenhouse effect inside requires an amount of air conditioning that's embarrassing. By placing the mass on the outside and having a hollowed core from where light is coming in a more controlled way, we went from using 120 kilowatts per square meter per year to 40 kilowatts per square meter per year. So this is not rocket science. By making this decision, you reduce by 300% the air conditioning and the energy consumption of a building. So these are the kind of things that we more and more will have to postpone our artistic agendas and eventually understand what are those constraints, are those conditions, orientation, cross-ventilation.
Would you say that architects have a right to be involved in politics in almost a way that your firm are doing now?
Well, if there's any power in design, that's the power of synthesis. The more complex the problem, the more need for synthesis. Among all the forces at play that are not only political, as you've just mentioned, they're also social, environmental, legal, also aesthetical. All those need to be synthesized and organized in a proposal key and then make it its way to the reality, from paper or the screen to reality. I would say that we normally try to, or we're expected from society as architects to deal with aesthetics or maybe having a better taste than the average person. And that's one of the dimensions of architecture, but not the only one. The thing is that we enter those non-architectural conversations and constraints through what we know to do better, which is form. Conventionally or historically, we architects have not been trained in being able to talk about the terms for which you should be accountable, because some of them are actually very hard to talk about. There are these unspeakable certainties that guide not just our profession, but life itself. Yet, I think we need to make the effort to be able to explain why we're doing what we're doing. And this is one of the good things about having been trained in Chile. Scarcity of means is not something that you should be ashamed or you ask for forgiveness or excuses. Yeah, maybe if I had more means, I would have done it better. I think scarcity, it's a great filter against arbitrariness. You are not allowed to do whatever you want. You need to justify what you're doing. But again, since it responds to tangible and intangible dimensions of the human condition, then the answer is not the pure need. It's needs plus desires. And I guess we're in a difficult environment. I wouldn't blame architects only. We have not been trained like that. But the nature of what we're doing, it combines these two aspects of things that you just know but can't talk about it. But we should make the effort for sure to be accountable to society that even gave us a commission. It's not that I wake up a morning with an incredible desire to do an office building. I mean, somebody has to need that building. And for that, I need to engage in conversation that explains that architecture is an added value and not an extra cost, which is the way we're, I guess, normally perceived by society.
So do you see in the future the need for architects who, so to say, have their fingers in multiple pies? So they are trained in multiple disciplines. They are professionally qualified to talk about really difficult and intangible subjects that you say.
Let me put it this way. I guess that ourselves were trained in that way, or society even expects from us or assumes that creativity is something that appears when you were allowed to fly free. I mean, allow your imagination to do whatever you want. So whatever you're imagining is so rich, so fantastic that we would like to see that in a built form in the world. Well, I think it's just the other way around. I mean, creativity is needed when the amount of constraints, when the amount of restrictions is so big that in principle you don't see any way out. That's when creativity should appear. And because of that, all those constraints, all those restrictions and starting points and expectations and needs, including those that are even hard to grasp, like desires, should be part of the agreement on what society should expect from us and what we should deliver back to society. In that sense, I would say that we architects have the obligation to speak those languages that inform the forms that we produce. In the end, those forces do have their own internal logic, the economics, politics, talking to people in a participatory design process. And more, we see society wanting to have a say in their built environment, rightly so. But this is not just a right. It comes with responsibility in the environment that we are working. Half of the square meters are built by people themselves. So it's impossible not to include them. So again, we have the responsibility and the obligation to speak those languages. But the way we should engage that conversation is with the specific knowledge of architecture, which is design. And design by nature is you shut up and you draw. And that is a very powerful moment because you don't give back a report that is linear. You know, you give back a design that is simultaneous. And this is the power of design. The type of challenges that we're facing that are complex, multidimensional, require that moment of synthesis. And at the very core of architecture, there's this very synthetic tool, which is design. So I guess that it's because sometimes we architects get confused that in order to understand politics or include that language, then you become a politician. Or in order to talk to people, you become a social worker. Or in order to understand the environment, you become a green. We have to talk that language, but recognize the fact that our contribution comes from what we know to do best, which is to design. And it is about translating those forces in a proposal key into something that was not there before you arrive to that place.
Alejandro Aravena there, speaking to Monocle's Jonathan Whitfield. My thanks to them both. The former's new book, Elemental, is published by Fiden and available from December the 5th, or as a pre-order, now. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this very show, and you'll also receive our sister podcast, delightfully named On Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You can also pick up the latest copy of the magazine, one of our many newspapers, or the books that keep us ever so busy all year long. Head to monocle.com for one of those little beauties. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the saintly Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fannett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.